It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, you might have some fond memories of checking out the I Spy books from the school library, or maybe reading them with your kids. The photographer who created the unique picture puzzles joins the show. First, when you were a kid, or maybe a grown-up, did you ever play with Matchbox cars?
Matchbox announces 10 cars America has been waiting for.
We're looking for a family car that's sporty enough for me,
yet practical for me.
I need a car that's built the way I use it. Tough.
Like every Matchbox car, each of our 79s has a sticker price of about a buck. No matter who you are, Matchbox has the car that says you.
I want a car that lets me express the real me.
Now, 40 years after that commercial came out, Matchbox cars have a place in the National Toy Hall of Fame. Joining them are Magic the Gathering, the card game, and the coloring book. So what makes all those toys Hall of Fame worthy? Chris Bench is the chief curator at the Strong National Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. That's where you'll find the National Toy Hall of Fame. Chris, good to have you back on the show.
Great to be with you, Rob.
Well, we've talked to you in previous years about the newest inductees. Before we get into the class of 2019, remind us how it works, how we get into the National Toy Hall of Fame.
Well, anyone can nominate a toy to the National Toy Hall of Fame. In fact, last year we heard from 4,700 people nominating more than 600 different toys. So then we take all those nominations, we look for the ones that have toys that have longevity, at least 20 continuous years on the market. We look for toys that are recognizable. We sometimes call them iconic. And third, these are toys that have the best qualities of play. So learning, creativity, discovery, socialization, these aren't the toys you shove under your bed after your birthday and forget about them.
And this is toys kind of broadly defined. It might be a game. It might be an object that we play with, like a stick or a rock.
That's right. We define toys really widely, as people do.
I could nominate, for example, the chair I like to spin around the studio with before the show starts. Can I put that up for next year?
You may. I want to see that in our inbox right away.
Well, it's an injury waiting to happen. Let's get to the new inductees, Chris. And let's start off. We just heard about the Matchbox car, the earlier ads. Now, this is interesting. Hot Wheels, as I understand it, they were already in the Hall of Fame, but Matchbox actually came first historically.
That's right. And I have personally, as a Matchbox fan, felt that that was a little bit of a crime that Matchbox was boxed out of the Hall of Fame and Hot Wheels zoomed past them as they did in 1968 when, with those super slick axles, they were faster than any other toy car. Matchbox caught up with its super fast line, and today they are both part of the stable of toys at Mattel and live happily side by side in kids' and grown-ups' garages.
Right. They were competitors in the toy car market until Mattel ended up buying Matchbox too. But they kept them, it sounds like, as unique product lines. Is that right?
That's right. Matchbox have always been a little more realistic than Hot Wheels. I know that I loved them for their hoods and doors that opened, other details that were just like the cars that I saw on the street, not quite so cartoony or race car as the Hot Wheels line.
And then another inductee this year, this is newer than Matchbox or Hot Wheels. It's a game, Magic the Gathering, this collectible card game that just took over the game market. I was there at Ground Zero when it happened, and I remember it mostly fondly, though it could get expensive, Chris. Talk about why Magic the Gathering made it into the National Hall of Fame.
Well, a couple years ago, we inducted Dungeons & Dragons into the National Toy Hall of Fame, and this is kind of a card version of that paper and pencil game with fantasy and spells and wizards and enchantments and all sorts of competition. What made Magic the Gathering unique was that everyone assembles their own deck of 60 cards. So you sort of literally stack the deck in your favor, you hope, by what cards you collect. And Rob, how did you do in your competitions?
You know, what ended up happening, so we didn't spend too much money, we had this arms limitation agreement, basically, where we would buy decks of cards together and draft them, so it wasn't a matter of who spent the most money. I still, in practical terms, I was never very good at it, but I did play and try to keep up.
So you were only a minor part of the 20 billion Magic the Gathering cards that have been sold.
That is correct, yes. I might have had a three-digit number of cards, I'll say that, by the time I peeked out there. But people, people had many more.
And no Black Lotus in your collection.
I never had a Black Lotus. Right. Those are still good for a lot of money, right?
More than $100,000 the last time I checked.
Wow, I'll check my cupboard again and see if I have one of those lying around. We're talking to Chris Bench with the National Toy Hall of Fame, looking at the newest inductees this year. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of these three, the Matchbox Car, Magic the Gathering, the collectible card game, or the coloring book? Or do you have a favorite toy from your own childhood and or your kid's childhood that you would want to nominate for the Hall of Fame, or just find out if it's in there or make the case for it? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, that leaves another new inductee, the coloring book, Chris. And that seems like it's made a comeback, too.
It has. It's been around since the late 1800s as a paint book. Parents hated those. Paint was so messy. Thank goodness Crayola crayons in the early part of the 20th century made coloring so much neater. Crayola crayons got into the Hall of Fame the very first year, 1998, and it's been a little bit of a gap that the coloring book wasn't in to accompany Crayola crayons.
Can you talk a little bit about the history of coloring books and how they've changed over the years to where we've now got a lot of grown-up coloring books?
Grown-up coloring books has been a huge growth industry in the last decade. They have taken on bestseller status. This isn't just your kid's My Little Pony or superheroes coloring book. Dinosaurs are classics for kids, but grown-up themes, complicated artwork for people who are interested in beautiful achievements and maybe some kind of serenity that we don't achieve with our electronic devices. Turn those off, do something analog, and create a picture that you can be proud of, even if you don't have artistic skills.
Yeah, that's me in that last category. And I got to say, people do these for stress relief. I was never good at coloring inside lines, not because I'm a rebel. I'm just really terrible. I find them kind of stressful. Are you a coloring book guy to this day, Chris?
I am not. I haven't caught the bug on that, but maybe I need to put one on my holiday gift list and give it a whirl in the new year.
Okay, those are the three that made it in. What were some of the other nominees this year, the finalists that didn't quite make the cut?
Well, there was sort of a constellation of toys from the 80s. Care Bears, Masters of the Universe, and My Little Pony were all finalists. So if you grew up in that era, you were probably rooting for any one or multiples of those.
And there's because they have to have been around for a while, we might see a crop of toys from a particular generation all showing up at the same time, right?
That's right. And we also see popularity of toys sort of rise and crest as parents have kids and they look back to the toys of their own childhood. I turned out okay, so my kids should have the same toys.
Interesting. Now, are there toys that people nominate that you look back and say, it was kind of a one-hit wonder, it was a flash in the pan that lasted 3 years and didn't have that staying power?
There are lots of those. So that longevity criteria really winnows so many different toys out. And sometimes people say, why aren't there more dolls other than Barbie and Raggedy Ann in the Hall of Fame? It's because dolls don't seem to have as much staying power as some of the other games and toys on the market.
We're talking about toys and this year's inductees into the National Toy Hall of Fame. Coloring books, Magic the Gathering, and Matchbox cars are the newest additions. Chris Bench is our guest. He's the chief curator at the Strong National Museum of Play. That's the home of the National Toy Hall of Fame in Rochester, New York. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you play with coloring books, Magic the Gathering, the game, and Matchbox cars as a kid? Do you enjoy them as an adult? Have you shared them with the next generation? Or do you have another favorite toy that is in your own personal toy hall of fame and you want to find out if it's in the national one? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Especially interested to hear if there's a toy you played with as a kid and then brought it to your own kids. 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Chris Bench from the National Toy Hall of Fame in Rochester, New York. We're talking about this year's Toy Hall of Fame inductees, Matchbox cars, Magic the Gathering, and coloring books. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a fond memory of one of those toys? If it's not one of those, what is your personal Hall of Fame toy from your old childhood, from your own childhood or that of your kids or both? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Linda is with us in Middleton. Linda, hi.
Hi, I'd say Play-Doh is my all-time favorite childhood toy. And when I would think it was about 8 or 9, my dad made me give up my blanket. And he said if I gave it up, I would get a toy. So I bought a Play-Doh machine.
Ooh, okay. Was this one of those machines that you could kind of squeeze the Play-Doh through in funky shapes?
Yes, and it broke in a couple weeks.
Oh, no. But you could still play with the Play-Doh then, right, Linda?
Exactly, yes.
All right. Linda, thank you so much for sharing that. Chris, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Play-Doh is already in the Hall of Fame, right?
It is. It got in the first class in 1998.
So it definitely a classic. And did I read, I thought I read somewhere recently, Play-Doh was invented originally as a thing that you removed like smudges from wallpaper with?
Absolutely. You rubbed down this gunk on your wallpaper and took the soot and smudges off, something we don't even worry about today.
Let's talk about the invention of toys. I imagine that's a story you're interested in at the Museum of Play. Sometimes toys come from surprising places and people.
They do. In addition to Play-Doh, Silly Putty was going to be a replacement during World War II for hard-to-find rubber resources. It was stretchier than rubber, bouncier than rubber, but it had a problem for your environment and ours. It froze and shattered. So really rotten tires in Wisconsin and upstate New York.
Linda, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to John with us now in Atoma. John, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I used to play with Matchbox. They were a big thing with me when I was growing up in the 60s. I grew up, but one of my favorite toys that I can remember was the old cap guns, the old cowboy cap guns. I had the holster and the chaps and the vest and the hat. We used to play cowboys, you know.
And did you sync them up with cowboy movies and TV shows, John?
Yeah, because back then, you know, remember there was Bonanza and Gunsmoke and all them shows going on, you know, so it kind of was a spin-off from them old westerns too, you know.
John, thanks a lot for the call. Is the cap gun in the National Toy Hall of Fame, Chris?
It is not in yet, but certainly the way westerns dominated the TV airwaves in the 50s and 60s, cap guns are in the museum's collection of more than 500,000 items. They just haven't made it into the Hall of Fame yet.
Now, he mentioned, Bonanza and other shows. You could add cap guns without those. But often toys are inspired by TV shows and, I guess, vice versa. Do a lot of those product tie-ins, Chris, end up being classic toys?
They do. The big one I always think of is Star Wars action figures that proved to toy makers that you could make more money off the products than the movie makers made off the film.
Thanks, John, for the call. Rob joins us next in Winona, Minnesota. Rob, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What toy do you have for us, Rob?
Well, I have a question about Matchbox because, of course, Matchbox started in England before it came to the United States. And so I wonder if the English Matchbox cars are included in the Hall of Fame. Those are my favorites.
Rob, thanks. Chris, do you distinguish between the English and the American Matchboxes?
We do not. We have inducted the entire run of Matchbox when they were made by Lesney in England and when they've come here to the United States under a number of different corporate sponsorships.
Do we have to roll the English ones down the other side of the track? Was that a distinction they made?
They put out a lot of English models initially, so it took a while before they caught on that Americans wanted to see American-made cars.
Rob, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Chris Bench from the National Toy Hall of Fame. Three new inductees this year, the coloring book, the Matchbox car, and the card game Magic the Gathering. Back to your calls now. Jeff is with us calling from Crandon. Jeff, hi. Jeff, are you there?
Oh, yeah, I'm here.
Yep. What toy did you want to bring up, Jeff?
The G.I. Joe figures.
Ooh, and now did you play with the big ones from like the 70s or the like shorter ones from the 80s era?
80s.
Okay. Jeff, thanks a lot for that call. Yeah, the G.I. Joes were invented and reinvented over time, Chris.
they have morphed, definitely. And they were 12-inch toys. I almost said the four-letter word that they were never to be described as dolls. Hasbro said you would be fired if you used that term around them. But action figures, that's how they were introduced in the 1960s. And you're right. To compete with Star Wars action figures, they shrank down, they lost detail, they became all plastic in the 1980s. And that's the form that they most frequently continue today with a whole slew of characters.
We're in my zone for toys here, me and my younger brother. And now the Star Wars guys, you couldn't bend them at the elbows or the knees, but the G.I. Joe people, you could. That was quite an advancement as we saw it at the time.
The articulation that G.I. Joe has always had at his joints, yes, the posing, and that they stayed in the position that you molded them to.
And are the Star Wars toys is G.I. Joe in the Toy Hall of Fame?
He is. He got in there before Star Wars, as we might think is appropriate. So they're both coexisting in the Hall of Fame.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Dan with us now in Wisconsin Dells. Dan, hi.
Hello there. I'm calling about the Evel Knievel motorcycle that probably came out in maybe the early 80s. You would slap him onto this. I don't know how to describe it, but you would wind it up and then he would take off. He would do willies. And then they came out with the Evel Knievel rocket, was the same as it was a big dud. In fact, my cousin Dave got it for Christmas and he cried because me and his brother got the motorcycles.
Oh no. Dan, and did you have Evel Knievel jump over the canyon?
Well, they had a step down living room and we always thought that his dad built that living room just for that purpose because it would fly a good 20 feet.
Nice.
It was probably the coolest toy ever.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate that. Chris, has Evel Knievel made an appearance in the Toy Hall of Fame?
He has not. He's an example of one of those brief popularity toys. He is sensationally popular amongst his fan base, up there with Stretch Armstrong from a similar vintage.
Thanks a lot for that call. That reminds me, my first pinball machine in my non-illustrious pinball career was an Evel Knievel machine. Is the pinball machine in the Toy Hall of Fame?
It is. It was an inductee just last year, and we have hundreds of pinball machines at the Strong Museum, so I am prepared to sell you tokens when you come to visit.
Do you have Evel Knievel?
You know, with all the pinball machines, I can't think of that off the top of my head. Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for that call. Greg joins us now in Madison. Greg, hi.
Hi. I had an action figure. This falls underneath that G.I. Joe thing, but the $6 Million Man action figure with the I had the whole set, so it was the actual office. When I say set, it was like the
TV show set.
The TV show set, right. There was a desk and there was an exploding briefcase and I had the Oscar Goldman, his boss doll. I just said doll.
Uh-oh. That's...
It was fun. It falls under that G.I. Joe. I mean, there was that 12-inch articulating, action figure.
And, Greg, thank you so much for that call. Who wouldn't want to recreate Oscar Goldman from the $6 Million Man, Chris?
I don't know. And there was the Bionic Woman doll/action figure, too. So you could have an entire clan of action figures out there from that era in the 70s.
I'm guessing that one was too short-lived, Chris, to make it into the Hall of Fame.
It was, but I just included her in an exhibit, and the $6 Million Man is also on display.
Fantastic. Greg, thanks for calling in. Pete joins us next in Milwaukee. Pete, hi.
Hello, I'm here.
What'd you want to bring up, Pete?
Well, I wanted to ask about whether the Parker Brothers Game of Risk was in the Hall of Fame, because Risk has been around since the 60s. Played it with my cousins when I was 10 years old, and so it's way back historical, but it's been reinvented many, many times, something like Monopoly, with different skinning of different types of themes. So I would think that would be in there. It is like the granddaddy of the modern war game, chess being the granddaddy of all others.
Pete, thanks a lot for the call. I think you've got bad news, Chris.
I do. Risk was a finalist this year. It didn't make it in. I agree. It is a classic war game. It stayed up on a card table in our house day after day because we could never finish it in one sitting. I was always holding out in Kamchatka while the armies closed in around me.
Thanks for the call, Pete. Are there toys and games that are finalists year after year but never quite make the cut?
You know, My Little Pony is a five-time finalist.
Wow.
After being cut out of the rodeo again this year. So it is the one that is probably most yearning to be in the Hall of Fame. But yes, there are some repeaters, like Magic 8-Ball, I think had been six or seven times before it made it into the spotlight.
Thanks for that call. Let's bring on Helen in La Crosse. Helen, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Helen? Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to ask your guest. I teach recreation and play and leisure and toys, and we spend a little bit of time talking about toys that the children in the Holocaust, who were in concentration camps or in ghettos, the toys that the children made up are out of scraps. And I wonder if your guest included this in his museum.
Helen, thanks for the call. Chris, have you done an exhibit along those lines, or would you consider doing something like that?
We certainly would consider it. We haven't had the opportunity to share those kinds of toys in our museum. We've had handmade toys from scrap materials from people in impoverished areas of the world on display. Some of those handmade toys are some of the hardest to get our hands on as curators. They don't show up on eBay the way that branded toys, mint in box, do. So I'm always looking for those kinds of crafted, really meaningful, repurposed items that are so important to kids who may not have anything else.
Thanks for that call, Helen. And in our last half a minute, Chris, that speaks to the power of play, that in the worst of circumstances, we will figure out something to play with.
We do. The year that we inducted the cardboard box back in 2005, we got so much praise for that, and I still look at every refrigerator box with special affection.
Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Chris Bench, Chief Curator of the National Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. It's home to the National Toy Hall of Fame. We talked to him about this year's inductees, Matchbox Cars, Magic the Gathering, and coloring books, as well as other classic toys. If you want to make the case for your favorite or share any thoughts on this year's inductees, you can do that at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up, if you ever read I Spy books as a parent or kid, you may have wondered, how do they take those amazing pictures? The photographer takes us behind the scenes. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up with the merger of the nation's largest newspaper chains, the new company will own about 1/6 of all papers in the United States. We'll look at what that means for the future of journalism, especially local news. First, you might have some memories of poring over the detail-intense photographs of the children's book series I, Spy, maybe as a kid yourself or with your own kids. The first book was released in 1992, and 8 themed books were published, including the iconic Fantasy and School Days editions. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how the I Spy book scenes were made? Do you have a favorite memory or favorite book in the series? Call in at 800-642-1234. Walter Wick is the photographic illustrator of the I Spy book series. He's also authored, photographed, and illustrated many other series and books for children, including the Can You See What I See series. His latest book, out earlier this year, is called A Ray of Light. Walter, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Well, you've been doing a unique kind of photography and setting up these props and creating these puzzles. How did you get started on this path?
Well, I had been a commercial photographer in New York City, and one of my favorite clients was Games Magazine, which is a puzzle magazine. Mm-hmm. I was looking for work and traveling around with my portfolio on a subway, and I went up to the magazine and I had some game pieces in my photographs, and I showed it to them, and they said, oh, that looks pretty good. Keep in touch. And I needed work right away, so I didn't really know what that meant. So I went back to my studio, and I invented a little kind of photo puzzle and presented it to them, and they bought it. So that got me started in this kind of game, photo puzzle kind of world. That was back in 1980. So I did a lot of magazine covers and book covers. And one day I was cleaning my studio and I was arranging all these little bits of hardware on a light table, just trying to sort them out and organize, you know, washers and screws and nuts and bolts and pins and needles. And I liked the way they looked on the light table, so I just spent the next 2 days arranging those things. I took a picture. That went into my portfolio. And then I got a call from a woman named Jean Marzullo, who was working at as an editor of Let's Find Out magazine, which was a Scholastic publication. And we did a series of posters. Well, we did one poster based on that photograph that I had down in my studio, and a series of other posters. But it was that original poster that I did for her that caught the attention of Scholastic. And they said, hey, we could do a search and find using this style of photography. So Jean Marzullo was the writer, and I was the photographer, and that's how it started. That was 1992.
And in the I Spy books, for people who haven't seen them, you have these incredibly visually elaborate arrays of a ton of different kinds of props, and there's usually a puzzle, a little poem about what you're supposed to find in there. How do you go about setting up a page of that, a photo like that, with all these like meticulously placed little pieces?
Well, it's really a joy for me to do it. It's like making order out of chaos. But my photos actually look like chaos at first glance, or many of them do. And there really is a structure to the way I arrange things. And because if I just dumped a bunch of stuff on a table and took a picture of it, you wouldn't want to look at it for very long. So I spend, you know, 2 to 3 days, 4 to 5 days sometimes, just arranging these things. And as I do it, I'm getting more and more satisfied with the arrangement. And it's sort of an unconscious thing. It's an intuitive thing. There's no rules that I follow per se. And I think if at the end of a few days, if I'm liking the picture and my eyes can't stop roving all over the scene, then I think it's ready for the book. And I think the readers experience it in the same way. So that's the basic level. Now, those were the tabletop images with lots of little tiny things, and it could be the kind of, you know, found objects like the pins and needles and nuts and bolts and things that I was speaking about earlier, or it could be antique toys. You know, so usually the pictures are themed in some sort of way. But as the series progressed, I started to tell stories with the photographs, and those are much more elaborate, where I actually drew storyboards first. You know, I did sketches of what I was going to make, and we'd build elaborate sets. For example, I Spy Treasure Hunt is a story that takes place in a seaside village, and the village is made entirely out of HO train parts. And, you know, HO scale model railroad type of, features. Mm-hmm. And the concept in that book takes you through the village and up to a cliff top, and then you oversee the village and you have a map, and then you go and search for the treasure, as well as search for objects in each and every single one of those pictures.
Talking to Walter Wick, photographic illustrator of the I Spy book series. He's also done books including the Can You See What I See series. His newest book out this year is A Ray of Light. He's taking us behind the scenes into his studio. And Walter, I'm envisioning your studio. Now, I read these books to my kids and found stuff with them. And you've got so many different, you mentioned antique toys and little tool pieces and bits and bobs and this and that and numbers and letters and so much. Is your studio just this madhouse of props?
Well, it is when I'm in the middle of a book. It just looks like, you know, a bomb went off. But It's fairly organized now. I'm actually on my fifth studio. I've moved around a lot. My first two studios were in New York City, and then I had two different locations in Connecticut, and now I'm in Miami. And so I've learned how to organize, you know, and I have these gray, industrial gray boxes with lids on them, and they go on shelves and everything. It's a little bit like a kindergarten classroom with all the manipulatives that the teacher would have stored on shelves.
Now, take us to some of your more recent work, Walter, the Ray of Light book. It's science-themed. I think I'm seeing a lot of teachers and librarians wanting to use it for, you know, their STEM, their science, technology, yeah. engineering, yes. and math. What do we see there?
Well, it's a book about light and, you know, the behavior of light. And light is something I use in the studio every day. So over the years, I've become very much involved in, you know, the inner workings of it. But it was a little bit intimidating, I might say, to actually try to explain those inner workings to a young audience. But the book really was, it's a follow-up to a book I did called A Drop of Water, which was published in 1997. And that book is now in its 43rd printing.
Wow.
And so with this latest move to Miami, I decided I would slow down a little bit, you know, and not have so many of these big extravaganza model-made books and do something, go back to that sort of the basics of light and how it works and color and refraction so I really, really enjoyed doing that book.
One of the constant, earlier this year, right?
Yeah, it came out in February. Yeah.
One of the constant themes in your books, whether we're talking about I Spy or Ray of Light, is this, I think, sense of wonder. That's part of why kids react so well to it. Are you still able to feel that yourself as you're putting something together and realize, ah, this is it. This is taking me away.
Yes, I do. I think that's a great observation to put together I Spy and A Ray of Light, because it is about observing. And, you know, we learn about science through observation and experiments and that kind of thing. And I like to say that, you know, my books lack characters in them for the most part. I mean, they don't have like featured characters that talk and, you know, have a dialogue. But they are otherwise cerebral, you know. Even the search and find books can involve illusions or machines that, you know, like one of the famous pictures I did was called Levers, Ramps, and Pulleys, and it's a machine made out of blocks and toys where you push a marble down a ramp and it knocks over dominoes, and there's a series of events that ends up popping a balloon. And that machine really works. Now, it didn't have to work in an I Spy book because it's a still photograph. But I made a video of it, and I took it to schools and everything, and when I would talk to students, and they all knew how it worked. They could figure it out from the still photograph. So I always love this kind of idea of making your mind, you know, getting the gears going in the reader's head. And it's kind of the way I think. And the Ray of Light book is very similar in that sort of way.
As we wrap up, Walter, you sometimes share your work on your Instagram page. What do you take pictures of just for fun, just for your own enjoyment?
Well, the immediate environment that I'm in now in Miami, you know, I'm, you know, I, like everybody else, I use the cell phone camera when I'm out and about. I take pictures of my travels. I'm a big art history buff, and so I go to museums and I try to share my interests with people on the Instagram page, because I'm now getting a lot of former readers now doing photography professionally, creatives of all sorts, who message me and say they grew up on my books, and I really love that. I really love that kind of connection.
Walter, thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
You're welcome.
That's Walter Wick, the photographic illustrator of the I Spy book series. He's authored, photographed, and illustrated many other series of books for children. His latest out this year is A Ray of Light. Coming up, we'll look at the future of local news after the merger of the nation's largest newspaper companies. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a state lawmaker about a new wetlands bill that's arrived at Governor Evers' desk. Now the nation's two largest newspaper companies are becoming one. The parent company of Gatehouse Media is buying its smaller competitor, Gannett. Gannett's papers include USA Today, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the Green Bay Press Gazette, and others in Wisconsin's bigger cities. Gatehouse publications include the Palm Beach Post and the Akron Beacon Journal. It only has one here in Wisconsin, the Daily Reporter, which covers the state's construction and development industries out of Milwaukee. The new company will be called Gannett. According to researchers at the University of North Carolina, it will now own 550 daily and weekly newspapers. It's about one out of every six in the U.S., with more than 8 million subscribers. Reports also say the move is likely to result in thousands of layoffs. Jessica McBride is a senior lecturer in the Department of Journalism, Advertising, and Media Studies at UW-Milwaukee. She's also a contributor to Heavy.com. Jessica, good to have you back on the show.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
What's your reaction to this Gannett-Gatehouse merger, Jessica?
Well, I think it's pretty ominous, and I think most people who care about newspapers, and I'm one of them, are worried about this. And, you know, we've seen over 2,000 American newspapers stop production in the last 15 years. So obviously that's a bad trend for people who care about civic life and who understand that what newspapers do is special and very important when it comes to covering local communities. And with this new merger, you know, it's being called a level of consolidation that we've never seen in U.S. history. And your intro mentioned the new company is going to own one of every six newspapers in the United States. And one analyst had said, never before in U.S. history have we seen a single company own and manage so much of the American newspaper business. Now, that's only bad if we see negative change, right? If we see a reduction in resources, if we see a reduction in coverage. The concern people have is that both Gannett and Gatehouse, frankly, have histories of, you know, cutting the workforce, laying off reporters, in fact, even closing some newspapers in the past. And so, you know, obviously, people are worried there will be more cuts, fewer reporters, and that's a bad thing.
Can you talk about what we might expect to see? I've seen some reports say we could be seeing cuts of thousands of employees at this new Gannett company that's made up of Gannett and Gatehouse.
Right. I mean, the estimates are that we might even see up to 4,000 employees being laid off, jobs being cut. Now, those wouldn't all be in newsrooms when it comes, you know, when I'm talking about reporters. They wouldn't all be reporter positions. But obviously, too many of them, you know, probably would be. And Gatehouse, I'll say it again, they have a track record of this, unfortunately, in other states like Louisiana and North Carolina. In Massachusetts, they consolidated 50 newspapers into 18 when they took over, to give you a sense of it. And you had noted in the intro that in Wisconsin, you know, we don't have, you know, a string of Gatehouse newspapers. They tend to be in other states. But we do have very important publications, which are part of the Gannett chain. And, you know, Gannett has restricted the resources, you know, in newspapers across Wisconsin already. So it's not like they're starting from a robust, you know, perspective. We're talking about the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, which is, you know, the state's largest daily newspaper. We're talking about the Appleton newspaper, the Fond du Lac newspaper, the Marshfield newspaper, the Oshkosh newspaper. I think another change that you might see is an increased focus on the digital presence of these publications. I mean, obviously, that's something Gannett already cares about. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is doing very well comparatively in the Gannett chain. It leads the way with digital subscriptions, something like 40,000. The new CEO of the combined company actually doesn't come from a news tradition. He used to be the CEO of the Knot. I don't know if you know what that is, but it's like a wedding website. And so there's a belief that, you know, they're going to focus increasingly on ramping up, you know, the online, the digital product. I've always thought that someday we'll see, you know, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel cease daily publication of its printed product. That's something I thought we would see. And I will tell you one thing I've just noticed about the Journal Sentinel. I think they do a lot of really good work. I have a lot of friends down there in the newsroom, and I think they work really hard. But I've noticed, you know, the layoffs they've already had,
We're losing our connection with you, Jessica. We'll pick up that point in just a moment. We're talking to Jessica McBride, senior lecturer in the Department of Journalism, Advertising, and Media Studies at UW-Milwaukee, looking at the news this week that two big newspaper chains, in fact, the two biggest in terms of the number of papers, Gannett and Gatehouse Media and its parent company, are merging. They will own hundreds of local daily and weekly papers around the United States, including the USA Today, a national paper. Talk about concerns of what that can mean for local news coverage in Wisconsin and beyond. The new chain will own about 550 daily and weekly newspapers. Layoffs expected there. You're making a point. Sorry to cut you off, Jessica. We were losing our connection a little bit. You're making a point about the Journal Sentinel in Milwaukee.
Yeah, I was going to say that I've noticed that they set the conversation less in the community. You know, when I started there back in like 1995, I felt like when the Journal Sentinel wrote a big investigative piece or they exposed something that was going on, policymakers really had to pay attention to that. The community reacted to that. And nowadays, I think they do a lot of really good work, but I noticed they set the conversation less. They set the agenda less. They missed stories that I don't think they would have missed 20 years ago. And I think that's a result of the layoffs that have already happened. And there are times when I sit back and I do ask myself, who sets the conversation in the community these days, now that we don't have as powerful of a daily newspaper? I'm concerned that we're going to go in that direction even more so, you know, in other smaller communities as well, where there are Gannett publications. And I would point out another thing. There was a recent research study that looked at what happens in communities that do not have newspapers. They found that they tend to have higher bonding rates, which I thought was interesting. It's because there's nobody who's serving the watchdog function on government. They found that they have fewer mayoral candidates, so, you know, less strong civic engagement. And they found that there's greater polarization. We are now at a state where we have 200 counties in the United States that do not have a newspaper. They're called news deserts. And people are worried with this merger that we're going to see more counties like that. We will have fewer newspapers, fewer reporters covering local news, and there's a consequence to that.
Jessica, I think a lot of people follow national news to some extent. Do you think there's a hunger for this kind of local news that we might be losing, if not completely, then seeing a lot less of?
Well, because, you know, we're sort of inundated with so much information, and a lot of it is bad information. It's not credible. I think maybe there is a hunger. There's a thirst for verified, sourced, credible, nonpartisan information. And I personally have never been wedded to format. I don't care if it's a printed product or it's digital, but I am wedded to the ethos of the product. Like, I care about sourcing. I care about verification. I care about all of that. And I think people are really, they desire that maybe more and more because they don't know where to turn with all this stuff hitting them on social media all the time. And I wanted to just sort of briefly tell you a quick story, too. Like, I go back so far in this to the early 1970s. My first memory is walking in the Milwaukee Journal newsroom, 5 years old, holding my grandfather's hand because he was a columnist for 42 years at the paper. And I remember how vibrant it was then. I remember how active and exciting the newsroom was. And it was sort of in its heyday back then. And, you know, since then, we've just seen this series of cuts and cuts and consolidation. And I really think we all need to tackle this as a community crisis, as a crisis for the United States. We need to find a way to preserve what journalists do, what credible journalists do. And I really think with the advent of the internet, the issue has been figuring out the profit model. Like, it's not that people don't desire the product. People want information, and as we just discussed, they want credible information, and they need it, you know, more than ever. But you have to find a way to pay journalists, and you don't have as many advertising dollars with the digital presence, and that's the problem, right? And so you see nonprofit news organizations like the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism and ProPublica. You're seeing these attempts to try different profit models. And so I think obviously that's where sort of the game is at. We need to all come together, recognize this matters, recognize it's a crisis, and find a way to preserve it.
Jessica, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Jessica McBride, senior lecturer in the Department of Journalism, Advertising, and Media Studies at UW-Milwaukee. She joined us to look at the news this week about the merger between newspaper companies Gannett and Gatehouse Media, already the two biggest newspapers, now combining to own over 500 papers around the country. Baseball is never out of style, even in the offseason. The Milwaukee Brewers released their new uniform and logo this week with a throwback to an older style. Producer Bill Martins has thoughts. Hey, Bill.
Hey there.
So what, first of all, describe the new Brewers look.
It's the old ball and glove logo, which, Rob, I don't know if you knew this, but the B and the M can also stand for Bill Martins.
I did not know that.
Yeah, so that little known secret. But so the old logo was a kind of a royal blue. The new one is more of a navy. They got rid of a little bit of a white. They shifted the location of the baseball in the glove. And those little subtle changes, I'm just having kind of a hard time dealing with.
You would have liked to see exactly the old ball and glove logo come back? Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, I like what they have been doing. They used to roll those out on Friday home games. Mm-hmm. I thought the current, the ones they've had for the last few years with the M and the, you know, barley sprig or whatever you call it, looked really good. I thought they were classy. I didn't think there was a need to change them, but, you know, I don't make the decisions.
They did not consult with you, so you wish they'd stuck with that M for a while longer. And I guess they did. They didn't want to pivot too quickly on that.
No, I guess not. And, you know, I'm glad they didn't change it to something completely different that we haven't seen before. At least it's something that people like, and I think that'll, you know, be good.
I say Houston Astros circa 1975. That's the uniform to beat.
Those are good, too.
Bill, thanks a lot for the fashion tips. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.